I'm going to start things right off by going off script just to confuse Christine. But you will find in the readings and in the music through the course of this service that there was woven a thread of people who've been involved with and advocates for issues concerning poverty and homelessness. One of those is Mother Teresa, who was someone who knew poverty and homelessness rather intimately. She was born into a poor family. Her father died when she was very young, and her escape from poverty was through her vocation in the church. Arriving in India as a missionary in 1929, she saw the work that needed to be done to care for the poorest of the poor. By 1850, her work and her determination led her to found the Missionaries of Charity, which grew into one of the world's largest organizations serving the very poor, active in over 130 countries. She once said,
"We think sometimes that poverty is only being hungry, naked, and homeless. But the poverty of being unwanted, unloved, and uncared for is the greatest poverty. We must start in our own homes to remedy this kind of poverty." Mother Teresa also said, and paraphrased from sacred scripture, "At the end of our lives, we will not be judged by how many diplomas we have received, how much money we have made, or how many great things we have done. We will be judged by, I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was naked and you clothed me. I was homeless and you took me in." That was perfect. That was perfect. I want you to think this morning about waking up this morning, waking up from your bed, in your home. How do you spend the morning? Puttering down the hallway, putting on the coffee, checking your email and Facebook, reading the newspaper, getting changed and going about your day. Either you live alone, or you live with family, or you live with friends. But anyway, I would imagine that each one of us this morning came here from home. Charles Dickens was, like Mother Teresa, someone who knew poverty and homelessness intimately. His father was put into a debtor's prison when Dickens was young, and he had to leave school to go to work at a factory at the age of 12. Despite having little formal education, he went on to become the literary colossus of his age. With his later fame and fortune, Dickens remained throughout his life an advocate for the poor. His popular works repeatedly spoke against the evils of child labor, the need for social reform, and he vividly portrayed the desperate situation of Britain's lowest classes. He wrote, "Bleak, dark, and piercing cold, it was a night for the well-housed and fed to draw around the bright fire. And thank God they were at home. And for the homeless, starving wretch to lay him down and die. Many hunger-worn outcasts close their eyes in our bare streets at such times, who, let their crimes have been what they may, can hardly open them in a more bitter world." I would like to introduce Carl with these words. "Our lives have many chapters and take many turns that can both surprise us and challenge us to grow in ways we might never have expected. I met Carl when he was 18 years old, and I was 27 as we were both entering the music program as freshmen at the University of Rhode Island. Along with two other friends, we became congenial study buddies during those years before our life journeys took us out into the world in new ways that none of us could have foreseen at the time. Carl's years of travel, working for the Cunard luxury line, and serving as entertainment or leisure director on the QE2 for 11 years, was stopped short when he was struck with devastating illness. He will tell you more of his journey and his experience with homelessness. I am honored to share this service today with Carl, a dear friend and a man of gentle, generous, and courageous heart. Carl.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning.
It is such a pleasure to be here. We've started things off on such a light note with the bleak and dark. Do you need the more of the mic? Is that better? Yeah, I don't project as well as I used to. Yep, right up there. I'll handhold. That'll be easier. Yep. Just unwrap this, and there we go. Now you'll be able to hear me. I'm more used to the handheld mic in any case. I'm here today primarily just to tell you one story, and that is my story. I'm someone who had grown up in Rhode Island. I grew up in Warwick, and being a true Rhode Islander, I went all the way to Kingston to go to school. Any of you that are Rhode Islanders will understand that very well. I studied music there, as Christine had said. We studied together. And then what would have been my senior year, I decided I wanted to take an opportunity to go and study in Berlin. It was West Berlin at the time, which kind of dates this whole process. And I went, studied in West Berlin, had some wonderful opportunities there, a little bit of a brag, had a chance to sing with a professional choir, so I was actually paid to stand on stage and sing at the Berlin Philharmonic Hall with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. It was some wonderful opportunities. But life brought me back to New England, and I continued to pursue a career in singing the whole corridor between Boston and New York, while finding a job at the university. And I worked there in law enforcement, actually, for 9 years, while I was pursuing still the career in music. And singing, we used to joke about, we wanted to have matchbooks printed that said we will sing weddings, funerals, bar mitzvahs, holiday occasions, you know, anywhere. We were music mercenaries. And doing things like singing Christmas carols at the various malls until you wanted to strangle that good King Wenceslas. But life went on, and I realized that the singing career was never really going to go where I expected it to. So I began to look at other options and had a chance to take a job on a cruise ship. It was supposed to be a 3-month sabbatical, and I took a sabbatical from the job at URI. It was comfortable, solid, benefits, state job, all of those securities. And this was a job with no benefits, no security, but it looked like a great adventure. So I took the job on the cruise ship, and following that great New England tradition, I ran away to sea. And it was on the Queen Elizabeth II. I had no idea what a ship like the Queen Elizabeth II was like. I had never been on a cruise previously. I had never been on a cruise ship. I had no idea what that world was all about. My first contract, as Christine pointed out, my first contract read leisure specialist. And I thought, wow, okay, I can do that. And so we sailed from New York down through the Caribbean, down the east coast of South America, stopping in Rio de Janeiro, Montevideo, Buenos Aires, through the Straits of Magellan, up, stopping in Chile, in Peru, Acapulco, and it was somewhere just after Hawaii that I decided this is not a sabbatical anymore. I'm staying. And I stayed at sea for 11 years. And it was wonderful. I worked my way up to being a social director on the ships and then being an assistant cruise director and then a cruise director and entertainment manager. And it was just such a great life. It was the champagne and caviar lifestyle. It was hosting entertainers like Bob Hope and Rita Moreno and some of the top names in the entertainment world. And as I said, I did that for 11 years, but decided finally that I thought maybe I wanted to find a job that was more stable. When I say that, that includes finding a job where the floor didn't move under me all the time. So I came back to Rhode Island and got a job in retail management. And had a good time with that job as well. It was very successful. My career path, as I saw it then, was right on track. I was at that point in my early 40s, getting ready to buy a house. I had the down payment socked away and a healthy savings account and the 401k and all of those things that you're supposed to have at that age. And I thought that by this stage in my life, I would be set financially. I would have a house fully paid for here in Rhode Island and be buying my vacation house in Costa Rica or somewhere. That I had been successful enough that these were the goals that I had set in my mind. And then I began to find that I was slowing down. In 2002, I was out of breath, much as I am right now. That just happens now and again, but you'll excuse me if I'm a little bit out of breath. I was out of breath a lot of the time. I was not able to keep up when we went hiking, when we went canoeing, doing all the things that I had always wanted to do. I used to be very active. And I wasn't able to keep up with my friends and couldn't figure out what was going on. And coming out of the winter of 2002, I had developed a cold that turned into a heavy chest cough that just would not go away. And I recognized a bronchitis and said, well, this could be something more serious. I better go get it checked. But having been someone who always had good health, I didn't think twice about worrying about a serious condition. Part of the whole thing of working on ships is that before you rejoin any ship, you have to have a complete physical. They can't take a chance on you getting sick when you are 3 or 5 days from the next nearest port. So you get a full physical with each contract. So I was having physicals 2 and 3 times a year while I was at sea. As far as I knew, I was perfectly healthy. But I went to the hospital to get it checked in any case, and they diagnosed double pneumonia and sent me home, gave me the antibiotics, said, go home, take these, you'll be fine. Because they saw an otherwise healthy early 40s man with pneumonia. The next day, fortunately, some family came by to help me to get lunch, and they noticed that I was still wheezing, that I was not able to breathe, I was getting a little bit cyanotic, and they said, you know, these are not good signs. I was kind of turning blue and having trouble, real trouble breathing. So they said, you're going back to the hospital. And they took me back to the hospital, and it's kind of a good thing they did, because that afternoon, I, as you see in all the television dramas, I met the cardiac paddles. I lost 3 days, have no idea what happened in those 3 days, was never able to catch up with the newspapers, but lost 3 days entirely. And when I came to, they told me that life was going to change completely, that I had a cardiomyopathy. They didn't have the exact cause at that point, so they were just saying it's an idiopathic cardiomyopathy, meaning we don't know why this happened. It turned out after the fact that it was a genetic predisposition. We found a number of members of the family that have also had similar heart failure issues due to a cardiomyopathy. 3 of us in this generation have now had significant issues, but I'll get to that later. And two other members of the family in the same generation are now being evaluated for the same problems. But in my case, they were telling me that I would never be able to go back to work, that I would never be able to, or at that point, not be able to pick up anything heavier than 10 pounds. That's a gallon of milk. Life was gonna have some pretty large changes. I lost my job, of course, and with the job, I lost my health insurance. Now, being a healthy, early 40s kind of guy, I didn't think I needed to be heavily insured to begin with, and then began to find all of the extras that the health insurance that I had that was inadequate to begin with didn't cover. So I had enormous medical bills. This is in 2002, and right out of the gate, I was hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to the hospital. And that went on with me now unable to work, trying to pay for doctors, trying to pay for prescriptions. My prescription costs at that point were in the neighborhood of $2,000 a month. And I was trying to do all of that out of pocket, assuming, well, I can get healthy again and I can get back to work. Well, it was not going to be a get healthy again, get back to work situation. I began to burn through the deposit that I had saved for a house pretty quickly and burn through my savings and burn through everything that I could cash in, and knew that things were beginning to get pretty desperate when I said, wait, what do I have that I can sell? I've got some nice antiques here. I'm sure I can get something for that. I was selling my furniture, selling other things that I had that had any value. And I was thinking at that point, well, this is pretty tough, but I can get through this. In 2004, I had a sudden, rather strange episode, was back in the hospital, and they found that my heart was throwing clots because it was not beating regularly. It was throwing clots out, and I had blood clots in both legs. So that started my journey with surgery. I had to have blood clots removed from both legs, and my heart was not doing well enough at that point. That is what I call my Civil War phase, because I was all blue and gray. My skin was gray all the time. My lips and my nails were blue. So I describe that now as my Civil War phase. And it began to look like things were not really going well. I also began to learn that when you are having misfortune, some of your friends are right there with you, and some of them, not so much. And I have a quote here that I think conveys that fairly well. It's from Daniel Quinn's book, Beyond Civilization. And, excuse me, he talks about a castaway in the sea going down for the third time. And he caught sight of a passing ship, and gathering his last strength, he waved and he shouted, and someone looked over the side of the ship, saw him, and said, "Get a boat." And yes, there are people who respond that way. You're in pretty desperate straits, and they're saying, well, you know, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Get out there. You can find some kind of work to do. You can, you know, they don't offer any help or suggestions. Well, this went on in 2005. I had my, and it's a phrase I never thought I would be uttering, I had my first open heart surgery. And they did as much repair work as they could. They, because my heart was gradually losing its shape, they repaired a couple of valves. They put in a bovine replacement valve. I had cow parts. And being who I am, I was someone who kept asking the doctors, if I have a cow valve in my heart and I eat a hamburger, does that make me a cannibal? The doctors would just look, they kind of roll their eyes. But in that period, having just had heart surgery, I lost my apartment because I couldn't afford to keep it any longer. I was couch surfing. My friends and family were doing everything they could to take care of me. But how many people can afford to just take someone in and feed them and house them and all of those things? It's adding another very large responsibility to any family. So I was couch surfing, moving from one place to the next to the next. Various friends tried to help me. I had folks that I knew who were selling their houses, and they said, well, you can come and stay here until the house sells. And I became their good luck charm, because that happened to me three times. As soon as I had moved in, within a month, they had a closing on the house. So it was very good for them. But here was me not knowing where I was going to sleep next month, next week, carrying my belongings around in plastic tubs that I couldn't even pick up myself. And I began to, excuse me, I get a little bit weird about this sometimes. I don't know why. But I began to be afraid. I began to think that I had always had this compass, that I had had a certainty that things would go a certain way. And things were not going exactly the way that I thought they should go. Now, intellectually, I know that it's silly, but emotionally, I began to think, I'm never going to be certain of anything ever again. And I began to look at some of the damage that that was doing to me emotionally, the damage that it was doing to my self-esteem, and you begin to question yourself and ask, what did I do to deserve this? Am I here because this is where I belong? Is this what's supposed to be? Well, it was one of those add insult to injury periods in life. And while I was struggling with those thoughts and wrestling with trying to look at, oh, the doctors had said, you're going to need a new heart. That's going to be the only solution to this if you're going to stay alive. So I went to Tufts Medical Center in Boston to have the evaluation to see if it would be possible for me to get on the transplant list there. And they said they had programs that could help me to pay for all of that so that they knew they could do it there and I wouldn't have to worry about the finances of it. And part of the evaluation, there were many parts of the evaluation, but in one part of the evaluation, they found that I had cancer. So I had to have surgery to have the cancer removed and then go through radiation treatments before I could be accepted on the transplant list again. It's one of those wonderful oxymorons in the medical world that to look at transplant, you have to be healthy enough to get a transplant. Doesn't make a lot of sense at all, but when they told me that I wasn't healthy enough to get a transplant, I said, well, you know, I kind of knew that. But they worked very hard at getting me healthy again. In that period, things started to look very dark. I was living in a basement apartment in South Providence behind, it was a room, really, I can't call it an apartment, behind the furnace. I had, my regular visitors were rodents and all other little critters. It was pretty ugly. And it was a neighborhood where some of my friends were afraid to come and visit me. But it was all that I could find that I could get into. And someone was kind enough to let me stay there and not charge me rent for the room. I look back and wonder sometimes, were they really doing me a favor or not? But I felt like I began to go into what, and there are several spiritual philosophers that have discussed the dark night of the soul. St. John of the Cross talked about it in his poem of the same name. C.S. Lewis went through a very dark period, and he referenced having a dark night. Mother Teresa was another who went through an extended period of depression and trying to figure out how she could not in any way feel connected to the universe, to the divine, how she could feel that she was completely by herself. I have followed spiritual practices of various kinds through my life. I practiced yoga for years and years and thought that that would help with the process. I had prayed in various forms my whole life. I had practiced meditation since college, since those days back at URI. And music for me was always a spiritual act. And none of those things, having practiced them for years, were really any consolation at all. And things began to look very, very dark. But there was a little bit of light at that point, and just to give you a little bit of perspective into the situation of the homeless and the disenfranchised in our society, after a 4-year battle living the life as I was living it, with the medical issues that I had, now both heart disease and waiting for transplant, and being a cancer survivor, I was finally, after 4 years, approved by the Social Security system to get some kind of income. And yes, that did open doors. It allowed me to have Medicaid, which helped with prescription drug coverage and some of the issues that had really been tough, because I had reached the point that I was having to decide, well, do I eat today or do I buy the drugs that I need? And that's not a good way to stay healthy when you're looking at major health issues. So I had the checks now in my hand from Social Security, and I went to the bank and said, I need to cash these. And they said, do you have an account with us? And I said, no, but I'll deposit them and open an account. And they said, what's your address? And I didn't have a permanent address. They wouldn't accept a post office box. So I was not able to cash the Social Security checks that were the first income I had had in 4 years. And it was very, very frustrating, but also gave me some insight into some of the stereotypes when people say, oh, those homeless people, they're so dishonest. Well, they kind of have to be, because if they tell the truth, they're not going to get the help that they need. If you say, well, I don't have a permanent address, you can't cash your check. I had gone to the little check cashing stores. I had people driving me all over Warwick, Cranston, Providence, trying to find somewhere that would cash the check. And it again being a Rhode Island thing, I finally found someone who knew someone who was an officer in the bank who managed to have enough influence to say, you will open an account for this person. And then I could begin to deposit the checks and begin to have some semblance of a financial life again, that it wasn't completely and entirely a hand-to-mouth existence. In that same period, I found the House of Hope Community Development Corporation in Warwick, and they provide housing for the disabled and the homeless. They are one of the many charities that was able to help me along the way. They had room, it was a room, in one of their properties. It was just a room with a bathroom attached, but it was a place that I could go in, close the door, be by myself, and focus on healing. And that's what I did, and just worked at getting healthy. My entire focus was, I have to get healthy enough to get this transplant. The doctors were good enough to go to bat for me, and after I'd finished my radiation treatments, they accepted me back into the transplant program after only 2 years from the cancer surgery. Now, it's supposed to be 5 years after your cancer treatment is finished that you're eligible for transplant again, but they somehow got around the rules and got me back to the transplant list. In 2007, I finished my radiation therapy, and then in 2008, they had installed a pacemaker, a defibrillator, and I had acquired a pump that went with me everywhere. It was hanging from my shoulder and was pumping medication straight into my heart. And that all kept me going, sort of, until spring of 2008. And then my defibrillator fired when I was at home, knocked me to the floor. And when people say, you'll hear people who've had a defibrillator go off say, boy, that kicks like a mule. Boy, that kicks like a mule. And so it knocked me to the floor, but it did keep me going for long enough that I could get to the phone, call for help, and they took me into the hospital and kept me at that point, just said, you're not going home until we have new parts. So that was spring of 2008. And then I lived in the hospital for that entire summer, and in the fall, they were able to find, it was September of 2008, they were able to find the new parts that I needed. So I am, again now, a bit more the bionic man. I'm put together from loose parts, but it's the greatest gift that I think anyone could ever give. And part of that statement is actually the question also, is there anyone out there who's not an organ donor? If so, please see me after the service. We need to talk. I'm serious about that. And I began to look at that point, finally, at what was it that got me through this, because my normal spiritual practices seemed all to have failed. But then I began to realize that it was one of life's very large lessons, and that was that life is just not going to be what you expect it to be. And those lessons on the ephemeral, on the brevity of who we are, of what we are everywhere. They're through the scriptural literature across the board. One of my favorites while I was in the hospital recovering from the transplant was the Buddhist text at the end of the Diamond Sutra. And they talk about how to contemplate existence. And the lesson is, like a drop of dew, a bubble floating in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, an illusion, a phantom, a dream. There are a number of truisms that go with that, that I used to laugh at people who would quote these truisms at me, and then I realized that, you know, some of them are actually true, that they do work. And one of my favorites started to be, life is not about waiting for the storm to pass. It's about dancing. Excuse me. Having more trouble getting through this than I thought I would. It's about dancing in the rain. So you don't wait for the storm to pass. You don't sit inside where it's safe and quiet. Another of those truisms that I thought was great, which someone brought to me one day, was falling down is life, but getting up again is living. So it was not necessarily the practices, the strict spiritual practices that got me through all of this. It was the people around me who got me through all of this. It was the people who brought me these texts, who said, hey, you need to read this, people who sent me cards. And through that, and with my very long lesson in life being as temporary as it is, and as ephemeral as it is, I began to see that I am where I am. It may not be where I wanted to be, not where I chose to be, certainly not where I'd have chosen to be, but I am exactly where I am. And I am there for a reason. Without these experiences, I would not be the person that I am today. I would not be short of breath like I am right now. I would not be as impatient as I am today, because I look at life now and say, things have got to get done. I don't have a lot of time to do things. So things have got to get done. I would not be as confrontational as I am today. I used to be, especially when I was working on the ships, all diplomatic and nice, and you couldn't confront people. You had to find the polite way around. Forget that stuff. No, when something needs to be said, you say it. Doesn't matter if it's pleasant or unpleasant. If something needs to be done, you find a way to get it done. So I certainly would not be as confrontational. I would also not be out here speaking on behalf of the people I speak on behalf of. I'm now a volunteer speaker at the Rhode Island Coalition for the Homeless. They have a speaker's bureau. I would not be speaking for them. I would not be giving voice to people who might otherwise have no voice. Excuse me. I'm all snuffly this morning. I wonder why that is. Proverbs 31:8 is a great text that says, "Speak out on behalf of those who have no voice, and defend all those who have been passed over." There are a number of other wonderful verses that can be found in the literature around the world, and all of them admonish us to go out, find the less fortunate, and do something. And because I know how little time we might have, that's my admonishment today, is that we should all be out there doing something. I was so pleased when you played the Bach this morning. He's gone. He disappeared. I was so pleased when he played the Bach this morning because I was reminded of a text that is one of my favorites from one of the Bach cantatas, and a loose English translation would be very simply, remind us to consider that our days are numbered. And that is pretty much what I have to say. It's the ephemeral nature of things that is the real existence. And I don't see that as a negative thing in any way. I don't see it as saying, oh, our time is short. It's part of the beauty of why the ephemeral things, why that drop of dew, why that bubble in the stream are so beautiful, why that lightning in a summer cloud is so wonderful to see, is because it's not going to be here for a long time. It may be just a fleeting moment, but in that time, those little things can also do something wonderful. So I thank you for your time and hope that I've kind of spurred some folks into looking at the homeless issues, giving you a little bit of light into some of the difficulty that can be faced by the homeless. I went through a much gentler form of homelessness than most people who suffer severe homelessness. As I was saying this morning, or a little bit earlier this morning, I never had the experience with what someone I know called the concrete sheets. But there are people out there who do that every night. I have left some literature on the table in the hall next door on the Rhode Island Coalition for the Homeless, and that will give you some further information. Certainly anyone who would like more information on the Coalition for the Homeless or on what you can do to help the homeless, to make the burden that they carry a little bit lighter, please see me and I'll be glad to talk to you about it. Thank you.
As we become perhaps newly aware of the faces and stories around the experience and realities of homelessness, Carl shares and invites us to speak aloud and as a community the mission statement of the Rhode Island Coalition Speakers Bureau in the special handout in the order of your worship. Carl will lead us.
If you could join me, please, in hoping that, not hoping that, but saying that we will change the beliefs about homelessness. We will break stereotypes and misconceptions. We will educate the general public to gain support. We will put a face to the individual's suffering, and we will speak the truth to end homelessness.
We would like to close today's service with the words of the 14th century mystic poet Hafiz of Shiraz, words that we wish we could share with those who remain homeless everywhere.
You want me to say this? I wish that I could show you, when you are lonely or in the darkness, the astonishing light of your own being.
Please join in our closing circle.